Hi, I'm actor and comedian Griffin Newman.
And I'm film critic David Sims.
Together, we host Blank Check, a movie podcast where week by week we overanalyze directors' complete filmographies.
In each new series, we discuss filmmakers who experience early success and are issued a series of blank checks by Hollywood to make their own crazy passion projects.
Now, sometimes those checks clear, and sometimes they bounce, baby.
We're joined each week by incredible guests, including actors, writers, and directors. So you can follow Blank Check with Griffin and David on Spotify for new episodes every Sunday.
And welcome to Unspooled Bonus Reel. This is one of our mini episodes where we are interviewing a filmmaker, an actor, a talent, a brain that we really admire to ask them what three films they think should be added to the next round of the American Film Institute Top 100 list. Our guest for this episode is a director I really, really adore. Her name is Laureen Scafaria. She directed the films Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist. She did Seeking a Friend for the End of the World. And she did this year's Hustlers, a movie that I have seen several times, and it is just a whole bunch of wow. Laureen, welcome to Unspooled. We are so honored to have you here to talking about the AFI list as a person who I think has been making really phenomenal films for several years. You've been making great things. You've been writing great things. I think you have such an interesting perspective, and I want to hear what your perspective is on this list and what we need to add to it.
My gosh, I didn't realize that they hadn't updated it in this long. And there have been
12 years.
Incredible movies in the tens. There have been really great films. So I probably went further back than recent history. There's so many incredible movies in the last 9 years, though. I probably put more nostalgic names on here than, like, I'm saying There Will Be Blood, The Master, you know, there's so many great recent films, Moonlight, all these movies that probably deserve to be on there. I'm not going to talk about, even though they deserve to be on there.
I almost thought you might pick The Master because I know you're a fan of that.
I'm a huge fan of The Master and Phantom Thread. I watch that now every time it's on TV. I mean, he's obviously the greatest, so yeah, I can't help it. The Master, I could talk about it. I'm still not going to. I'm still going to go further back into my childhood, maybe a little more.
That's fair, because I feel like I see a bit of The Master even in Hustlers, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the dynamic between that mentor-mentee, that friendship, that love story between two people that, you know, when the relationship is kind of stronger than you have with, like, your parents or your children or your partner, that I was really interested in that. Yeah, that power struggle and that dynamic between two people.
But so then let's talk about it. Like, give me your number one pick. What needs to be added to the AFI Top 100?
I'm going to say The Princess Bride.
You're a person after my own heart. I love this movie.
I think it's perfect. You know, it's Rob Reiner who is, I think he's himself has made three of the top five movies of all time. I do. He's underappreciated for his effect on cinema.
It's true. What would your runners-up be from him?
Oh, I mean, When Harry Met Sally and This Is Spinal Tap. Princess Bride is, you know, it's William Goldman. I mean, it's a perfect script. The cast, it's so unexpected. It's so delightful. It's perfect scene after perfect scene. So many iconic moments in it. I think it fails the Bechdel test, which is a bummer, but it is in spite of that, I think it's still a perfect movie.
I agree. And I think it hits so many genres. You know, it just crosses them all really perfectly. It crosses fantasy. It crosses romance. It crosses comedy.
Yeah.
It is an everything movie.
It's adventure. It's all of it. It's like a true adventure story. And it's so funny. Wallace Shawn is so funny. He's so naturally funny, but it's such a perfect role for him. And Andre the Giant. I mean, I was a kid who grew up on wrestling. So Andre
the Giant. You're a Jersey kid.
Absolutely. If it wasn't George the Animal Steel, I am also in love with Andre the Giant. So, but Mandy Patinkin. I mean, ridiculous. Those three people, those three characters. Every speech, the fight that the two of them have, the sword fight. I mean, it's like, it's incredible. And Cary Elwes was underappreciated in that too. Robin Wright's kind of our first time really seeing her. It's just extraordinary.
Exactly. Like, we have kind of this, Cary Elwes is riffing off of the character that Kevin Kline is sort of, or they're all riffing off this like basic Douglas Fairbanksian, Errol Flynnian model, who's also, we don't have like Robin Hood or anything on the list.
Yeah.
But that mustachioed, handsome hunk.
Yeah. And he was mysterious at that moment because you didn't know who he was, if he was the Dread Pirate Roberts. She didn't know exactly who it was. I remember when I was a kid, literally not knowing that it was him. And I shame myself for that because I genuinely was like, oh, it was him the whole time. It was Wesley. And the framing of it too, the storytelling of it, this grandfather telling his grandson the story of it. And this kid who's like afraid it's a kissing book and he doesn't want to hear about that, but he does. And the moments that we snap in and out of it, it's incredible. It's beautiful.
You know, I've always quietly thought that if we were going to take one film from all of cinema, and, you know, it's not because Citizen Kane is, of course, at the top of the list.
That's great.
In terms of, you know, like of the AFI list is like great, monumental, tons of effect on the pop culture, tons of effect on cinema itself, on style and technique. But as a totally different question, if you're going to take one film and just use it to show an alien, what was cinema? Like, what did cinema do? I think The Princess Bride is a perfect pick.
Yeah, I think especially, I mean, if you're going to look at screenwriting too, Rob Reiner brought it to life and all these actors, but what William Goldman has done for writing is extraordinary, and he really is the voice of it. And I think that's what, you know, as you look at all the great movies that have been made, I feel like the writing is really what stands out and often an unsung hero of films because it's easy to, you know, look at the visuals and look at the stars and everything. But I feel like what William Goldman did there was like teach us writing in his script. He really did. I mean, he certainly actually taught us writing with his other books, but he really did teach writing with that.
I mean, what do you feel like you learned from it? Because you started as a writer.
I did. It perfectly juggles a lot of different characters. You know, it still has that like hero's journey quality to it, but so many of them have their own journeys. So it plotted that really well. It showed this like you have like, you know, good and evil, but they're a complex, you know, they're not even the evil is its own form of evil. And I mean, I think he just brought so much humor to everything and so much heart to everything. And the relationships, the sort of interpersonal dynamics between people is really what I think when he shines. But yeah, that the framing device, the grandfather, all of that was it's so smart. It's such a well-told story. It's also like it's scenes, you know, and I think that's what he did so brilliantly, was create these scenes and these iconic moments. And of course, what Rob Reiner did with them was extraordinary. But, you know, the duel, facing off with cups of, Iocane powder. that was next level. I mean, it really is so extraordinary how seeing characters react, you know, but really the scenes and these sort of cameo moments and, you know, Billy Crystal's, cameo moment. It's such a brilliant little tiny stop on the way, you know, on the road movie. So, I mean, as a person who I can't help but keep writing road movies in a way, even, you know, Hustlers is they're in cars for much of it. And depending on who's behind the wheel, it has a lot to do with it. But
and how nice the car is.
How nice the car is, exactly. But yeah, I, as someone who has written a couple of road movies and, you know, Nick and Nora's was trying to be the worst kind of road movie in Manhattan, the last place you should be doing a road movie. Seeking a Friend very directly was. The Meddler even was in a way, you know, the mom cruising around Los Angeles. And But yeah, Princess Bride as that adventurous, you know, they're on foot, they're in boats and everything. But in a way, it's a journey and a road movie, and so them going from A to B and all the stops along the way and all the characters that they meet along the way is really fascinating.
I think you're exactly right, and I think it's a really perfect example of taking something that is sort of seen as a formula, you know, the hero's journey or the epic quest, and figuring out how to make it yours.
Yeah.
You know, because we're in such a period of like taking ideas we know and people even just like subscribing too much to a template, like Save the Cat or something.
Yeah.
And figuring out how to take something known and still make it personal. You know,
they'll remake this. I mean, they are going to remake it.
Oh, God, so do you think so?
I think they just announced it the other day,
No.
This one's hard for me. I mean, you know, I get it, but this one feels very, I don't know, singular. And it's that tone. The tone of it is what's so perfect. And it feels like if people are trying to do that for a 2019 audience, that somehow that tone is going to get skewed. I'm not sure.
I don't think they could capture the purity of it.
No,
you know,
it's too
pure. To be a wink.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, that is a solid, solid, solid first pick. I mean, I hope they hear you because it shocks me that this film is not on the list.
It's shocking. It is shocking.
You ready for your number two?
I think so. This has to be because they haven't updated it, because The Social Network would, I think, undoubtedly be on the list. I can't imagine that doesn't crack the top 100.
I mean, why? You think because of its news relevance today?
It's perfect. It's a perfect movie. It's the movie of today. It just is. I mean, it certainly is resonating right now with what Facebook is known for at this moment. But it's so much more about the internet and its effect on us socially. And so to turn Mark Zuckerberg into a character, which he is, of course, but to create this person who, this opening breakup scene, this like 5 or 6 minute breakup scene in which this guy's just called an asshole and dumped, and that being the impetus of this sort of this kind of revenge, you know, this creation of Face Mash. And it's so incredible. It's such incredible writing. I mean, obviously Aaron Sorkin, obviously what David Fincher did, and this score, and unbelievable score, unbelievable. The sound of it is as much the storytelling as the writing itself. And it was so fun to hear Aaron Sorkin, like classic Sorkin dialogue delivered just through incredibly intelligent college students. I thought that was that's already a twist on all the other, you know, Sorkin movies and shows. I feel like that automatically was refreshing, and why that opening breakup scene is so interesting. And you just see this person who, he doesn't have what it takes. He is ill-equipped for these social interactions, to sit across from his girlfriend and to talk about these parties these clubs, and to want to be a member of these clubs, and the exclusivity of it, to sort of see that and to turn it into something.
To get the psychology of these people who, the people with his same personality template, are sort of conquering little pockets of the world.
Yeah, we have like 12 guys in Silicon Valley to thank for everything that's happening to young girls and boys. And
thank might not be the word out of here.
All of us, yes, thank might not be. Blame, but the idea that they've determined so much of how we interact with each other. Twitter is a place where we all give our thoughts in short form bursts, and everyone can read them, and it's so strange. I mean, if there was a wall, you know, in a town square, I don't know how many people would even choose to write on it. I really don't, but you put it in this place, and now it's there forever, and it's kind of incredible. So Facebook being this place that, you know, for me, I remember joining because I was like, oh, I want to see what the people I went to high school with are up to. That was incredibly alluring. That was, you know, I moved 3,000 miles away from them. I didn't go to a reunion, you know, I was like very curious. And so that was my reasons for it. And I quit recently. I think my page is just still active. I think they're active forever, even though, you know, I'm not technically on it anymore.
How was it to quit? Because I want to too, but it's the high school friends that I'm terrified that I'll never find them again.
I'm just choosing Instagram instead because somehow that feels like less obtrusive to my life. And, you know, I took Twitter off of my phone. I quit Facebook. I like this I guess I like pictures more than words in a way, as far as like, oh, I'll take this photo album, you know, this like kind of online digital photo album of mine, and mostly pictures of dogs.
Like, for a creative person, there are so many opinions on Twitter about film and what film should be that I can imagine trying to be a creative person, trying to write a script, hearing so many people's thoughts can be like paralyzing.
Yeah, and you certainly can't write that way, or at least I think some movies are really trying to write that way, taking the algorithms and turning them into dialogue and taking catchphrases and just applying them to everyone. It's a little hard because, you know, yeah, we all talk the same. We all have this, we're all having a collective experience. We're all reacting to everything collectively. That's so strange. And it's not just, you know, did you see Game of Thrones last night, which is already a form of pressure, you know, and with spoilers out there. But it's beyond that. It's our own relationships with ourselves. It's our relationships with our identities. It's like the yearbook staff has taken over. And if you don't live your life out loud, if you're not an extroverted person, if you're private at all, obviously, but it's impossible. It's impossible to navigate. I'm so grateful I wasn't raised in this age. I find it impossible. I don't know how they do it. And yet, you know, there's a positive effect. It's just, it feels like the experiment failed. It does feel like that. And it feels like for a little while there was this hope that the experiment was succeeding, because it felt like, oh, look, this is a place where there's unification. There's a place where people who felt alone no longer feel alone. And I don't mean just interacting with each other. I mean, I'm like this and I don't know anyone like this. That was the hope of it anyway, was that it was going to be like, you know, you don't need to travel around the world to understand each other. You can look online and see how this person lives their lives. And isn't that incredible? And I don't know. I don't know if, you know, the information superhighway, as it was known. I don't know if information should travel on a superhighway. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that.
Like, The Social Network is the one film that I actually really want a sequel to.
Mm.
You know, because it was a period piece when it was made, in a way, just by a couple years. And in the time since it came out, the world has changed again around that film and what Mark Zuckerberg represents.
I think Eighth Grade was the sequel to Social Network. I know him who made the movie, but I do think that. I think that I don't really care what those guys are up to anymore. I don't care what Zuckerberg's up to. You know, I care more about the impact on us all. And so I think that was its own, that was the sequel to it. But I know what you mean. I mean, it's damning. It's, you know, it's remarkable what took place. I think it was also, I mean, to get back to the movie itself, obviously, it's kind of just peak Fincher, peak Sorkin, peak Eisenberg, peak Garfield, you know. We got to see Rooney Mara. I felt like that was my introduction to her
anyway.
It
was mine too. And it's still, I think, my favorite Rooney Mara, to be honest.
I mean, she's great always, but I to see that female character even, because Sorkin doesn't often give them the same. I mean, you know, in his shows he does, obviously, but for some reason in the films, I feel like that was a very strong female character for him to write, and a perfect vessel for Sorkin also through that character. I mean, I took from this movie, I did, because I found the two depositions to be such an incredible framing device for the telling of the story, to go from that breakup scene to this long walk across campus back to his dorm. And that's where we hear that unbelievable score, just like the tension of that underneath, you know, is like, it's so minimal and it's such a perfect theme and it sounds like the future, but it's timeless. You know, there's something about it that was so incredible. But his long walk back, and which he's just stewing, and then bringing it back to the room where then we're hearing voiceover, but it's what he's writing, you know? And so, and then, you know, his friends start showing up, Eduardo shows up, and they're, you know, he's creating this thing that then goes viral. I mean, it really is an unbelievably structured script. It's really remarkable. And so that for me is there's so much to say. And then for it to end with him hitting refresh, you know, over and over. I know. It's incredible.
In that time since then, learning how they've programmed us to hit refresh.
Yeah.
Or programmed us to keep scrolling. Like them talking about in Silicon Valley, training our brains to need constant refreshing the way that he does, the way that we see him. And I don't even think when the movie came out, I was so aware of the design of apps to make us addicted in that way.
Yeah.
You know, we're just sort of like, oh, it's sad for him. He's refreshing. Look at him go. And then to really, I've been afraid, I think, to watch this movie since it came out. I haven't. Oh, you're making me really want to.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. It's just a historical work at this point.
Yeah, and we have all these movies, you know, for example, about like the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And a lot of that argument is like, well, we need the movie to commemorate the fact that the movie, that the experience even happened.
Yeah.
To which I feel like this is one of our generation's wars.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's, it arguably is the biggest impact. I mean, I felt like, you know, I'm old, so I'm like 41. I felt like we didn't have anything till 9/11. It did feel like there was almost nothing, you know? And then 9/11 and the internet. And, you know, those two moments impacted everything, I think, that we're experiencing now. And it's scary, the idea of making a 9/11 movie. It's scary. I thought, again, eighth grade was incredibly brave to try to tell the story of a 13-year-old girl trying to navigate this world right now. And but it felt like there was a giant hinge, you know, and then a more insidious hinge, you know, something else that happened that happened without us really knowing it. And now we're just on apps talking about the apps. Now we're just on Twitter tweeting about tweets. It's like the snake eats its tail no matter what. So it's I don't know how we come back from this. I really actually don't. I think the experiment failed, and I'm genuinely not sure how we come back from this. Because I remember with everything going on in the past few years in our country, and, you know, and I should say there are some incredibly positive effects. Like I said, people realizing that they're not alone, but also the unification of certain communities and the strength in certain communities. And my gosh, I mean, at this point, I feel like it's these like police videos and things like that that are, that's the benefit of it at this point, is sort of everyone collectively getting to point their fingers at something and say, you know, that's wrong, that's an injustice. So there's some of that happening. But even that, I don't know, it's so noisy by now. And I just remember when talking to, you know, older generations and them saying, like, we've lived through times like this. We've lived through the 60s. We know what this is. And you know, nothing but respect to them, but they haven't. They haven't lived through this. I haven't. I mean, I'm that generation that kind of straddles this time period. So, like, I feel like if you were born, you know, between, like, I don't know, 78 and 83 or something like that, you were not raised with it, but it's such a part of your life. And now, you know, and that – it's a very weird age to – continue to grow with this. This phone, I wasn't attached to this 4 years ago. My 71-year-old mother is on her phone all the time. My last movie was about my mom being, you know, having her relationship with her iPhone. It literally opened with my mother getting an iPhone and calling me on it all the time. But also the relationship that she had with it, it was in ways it's like a cure for loneliness, but it's also this, like, it's a new discovery for her. So we have so many different generations reacting and responding, and, you know, my mom wondering how to take a selfie, and I'm like, oh my goodness, it's a lot. It's a lot to unpack at any age. So I don't know how we come back from this.
I mean, I've always thought that that generation you're describing right now, that kind of middle one, you know, maybe even like pushing up to like the very early X's, that their power in getting to see the world before and after and really understanding it is what makes them, I think, maybe the ultimate storytellers to explain what happened to us.
Right.
You know, like,
well, I'm Gen X, so I'll take it. I'm Gen X, so I guess. I mean, I think just because we remember when, you know, but we don't, it wasn't like we were so far away from it that we weren't a part of it. When I was a freshman in college, so I was like a year younger than people, but technically a freshman in college, I remember going like, I do this thing called email with my friend Kara, and my friend Kara and I used email, and it was the way that we kept in touch with each other. Like, that's crazy. That's crazy. I don't feel ancient, you know, but that's wild. And so that's why even Hustlers could be this recent period piece, because, you know, this list was re-upped in 2007. That's when we start our story, is 2007. It's a different time on Earth, you know, and
that's true. Like, we were just talking recently, we were doing American Graffiti, you know, a film made in the 70s about the 60s, and it makes the 60s feel like a lifetime ago. And in so many ways, Hustlers is that same decade gap, but it also feels like a lifetime ago.
I love American Graffiti. That influenced Nick and Nora so much.
Okay, well, these are solid picks, 2 for 2. What do you got for us, number 3?
Here's the truth. I want to talk about Dirty Dancing. I really do. But I'm going to talk about The Birdcage because
The Birdcage.
I think The Birdcage is another perfect film. I also think Dirty Dancing is a perfect film. But, this is hard. This is hard, you guys.
I'm curious to hear these arguments.
For why both of them are perfect films? I mean,
maybe as you talk it out, you will decide which one you pick.
I'll get there. Okay. Well, listen, Dirty Dancing. Dirty Dancing is a perfect film. It's scene after scene of iconic moments. I think that's what is why Dirty Dancing has a place, a special place in my heart, because I didn't just see it 65 times when I was a kid, but I rewatched it recently when my boyfriend wasn't home, and I was just like screaming out loud, like I was a child again. And my crush on Patrick Swayze has never gone away. My crush on Johnny Castle will never go away. The director of the film, Emil Artolino, he made Dirty Dancing and then Sister Act, and then he died of AIDS a year later.
Oh, I didn't realize.
So, because I was so, when I looked up Dirty Dancing recently, because I was like, who made this and why has he not made anything since? I saw that and I thought, how tragic, because it's really an unbelievably well-directed movie. But it's just iconic scene after iconic scene. It's remarkable, but it brings me to The Birdcage, which is probably the reason that is probably the number 3. Mike Nichols, I mean, one of the greatest directors of all time. Elaine May wrote the script based on La Cage aux Folles. It's like a play. It's like a perfect play that he turned into a piece of cinema. But
which you would understand, because you playwriting specifically is where you started writing.
Yeah, I started writing plays. I mean, I wrote screenplays. I put that in quotes. I wrote screenplays in like fourth and fifth grade. So I was always interested in movies, but I really found it through theater. And even finding that, it was like really via David Mamet, being obsessed with the play Glengarry Glen Ross, and then seeing the movie Glengarry Glen Ross and being like, oh my God, now I want to do all of this. I want to take plays and turn them into films. I even took films and tried to turn them into plays. I tried to put Shallow Grave up as a one act in my college. I'm very interested in the melding of theater and film. But
which is so interesting, because it seems like there's such this easy negative catchphrase people say, which is like, oh, it's just a filmed play. Like,
yeah, but sure. And obvious, I mean, I think right out of the gate, Mike Nichols says, no, it's not, because he like brings you in this like incredible wonder. I don't even know what it is, a helicopter. I'm not even sure how he captured this, but he you know, brings us through Miami into this club and kind of this beautiful oneer and for the first time. And I think he's saying right then, this is not a play. But then he also lingers and rests on characters, and you see Robin Williams go through, trying to explain this moment of the Madonna, and it's like the camera just hangs on him and allows for these actors to have these brilliant moments. And but it's the writing of it is theater, and it's so contained, and it's such a perfectly constructed story.
And it's surprising to think back on how modern it felt telling that story in the 90s.
Yeah.
You know?
It was. And I mean, to look at it now, it's strange how much time has passed, and yet I don't know. I haven't really seen a piece of art like it. It had so much fun. And I, you know, in another way, maybe it wouldn't even be made today. I'm not sure. Or how it would be made would be, like you said, like, you know, taking Twitter algorithms and trying to type it into something. You know, I think it's such a beautiful relationship that Robin Williams and Nathan Lane's characters have with each other. And they sign like a palimony paperwork at some point, because that's how ahead of its time it was. It was before gay marriage was legal, and that's insane. And to watch the two of them have this long-term relationship with each other that's so rooted in love, but they're like opposites, and you know, Nathan Lane's character is so outlandish, but the love is so perfect, and for the son to love them, and for all the drama that unfolds in the movie is about these people trying to do right by each other and not hurt each other's feelings. And yet they're hurt. They're hurting. You know, the son shows up and is saying, this isn't possible. I can't present you as my family. And his father is so hurt by that. And to see them all try to whip themselves into shape for this cover, you know, for them to, you know, understand the motivations behind it while also being hurt. And every moment that you go, oh, I could hate the son for this, then he goes, forget it, I don't want to do this. And the father steps up and says, no, this is right. So it's sort of this beautiful tug of war with characters who are all trying to do right by each other while not trying to compromise themselves. And yet, you know, the situation is larger than them, and it's politics, and it's people that are very different from them showing up, and these two families interacting with each other. It is actually a story for now, in a way. It is a beautiful story for right now.
I mean, what you're making me think of right now is how often in storytelling we think of, you know, you need conflict to make a movie, and conflict is two people yelling at each other. Yeah. And the way you frame Birdcage is, it's a movie where the conflict comes from people trying to be nice to each other, which is completely different than how we usually imagine what good conflict is.
That's why it's so beautiful to watch and such an incredible lesson, because, you know, when I was writing The Meddler, that was an exercise in empathy, because I made my mom the main character and I made myself the side character. And I was trying to think, you know, what is my mother like? You know, I think people have seen the movies about overbearing moms, but they're often told from the kid's perspective. And what's it like, you know, yes, oh, my mom's calling me, my phone's ringing, it's mom again. But what's it like to be her? What's it like to be the person who called five times and didn't get a call back? And the loneliness that is involved in that, and her desire to put her love to a good place. And yet, here she is trying to be good, but she's failing at it. And her daughter does love her, but is grieving. And it really is just about them grieving differently. And so, you know, I like tension and drama that comes from that place. And we make mistakes too. And people, there's human error, and you cross certain lines, and you do things you shouldn't have done. So that happens, of course, but I think the beauty of the conflict and the tension coming from them all just loving each other and being hurt by each other and trying to take that love and do the right thing and trying to take that pain and do the right thing. And it's so funny and sweet and heartbreaking and it's hilarious. And you're laughing at that Gene Hackman. You're laughing at him. I mean, he has a monologue about foliage that I think is one of the funniest things on planet Earth as he's putting everybody to sleep, talking about, you know, the leaves and the red and the orange. And it's so funny. But the joke of it, of all of them, you know, trying to be themselves and then trying not to be themselves, trying very hard to be other people because that's what's going to be acceptable. I think those are the themes that feel so ahead of its time. And obviously it's based on something very old or, you know, from the 70s. And so there's, you know, a story in there already. But I think that's why when the movie ends, it's just over. There's nothing else you need to see besides Gene Hackman putting on that white dress and that wig and being snuck out of this club because they've gone through so much. And it's not like you're going to suddenly make these people realize everything that they've thought was different. And, you know, it's just that the family that you've been watching all this time is they're free and they're, you know, they're all free because now everything's on the table and they're all in it together in some way. And the love of these two children and these families coming together. I mean, you know, very different families coming together. I don't know. Those themes are just they're so relevant today. And
that makes me think of your Christmas scene.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's like a chosen family thing, you know? And I think I think of the family that that Robin Williams and Nathan Lane have formed, and it's not the family dynamic that people are used to seeing. It's not, you know, the husband and wife and the two kids, and I was excited to show what it's like when, you know, you maybe don't get the family that you needed or wanted, and the love that you can find with like a chosen family is just as beautiful and sometimes even more fulfilling.
Well, I love these choices. You have stuck up for so many things across the board that I feel like the list is a little bit short on, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's a shame that comedies can't be seen in that way. I think often people assume they've been laughing during a movie or enjoying themselves in any way, that it's not a serious work. But, you know, I don't know if AFI will change that much.
Well, we are working on it one podcast at a time.
Oh, good luck. Thank you.
And you are working on it by making one film at a time.
Oh, that's very nice. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you coming out.
Thanks a lot.